All right, thanks for the invitation to speak here. And please excuse my voice, I'm a little sick this morning. So I'm going to talk about entanglement entropy and JT gravity. And I should say this is a topic that some other people have worked on, like Jennifer Lin and Blomhard Mertens and Vishal. But here I'll have a little bit of a different approach. So this is a paper I wrote with my student David Kolchmeyer, and I'll also review a little bit of some of the work I did with Dan Harlow. Okay, so I'll have first some kind of introduction, which is mainly just the motivations for why I think this question is interesting. And then I'll discuss how some factorization maps will work. And well, the first part, I'll tell you what I mean by a factorization map. And it will turn out that there's some kind of universal topological defect to defining or giving a Lorentzian interpretation to the gravity path integral computations of entanglement entropy that explains the origin of the area term, I think, in a slightly different way than we usually think about it, and kind of a nice way. And then at the end, I'll discuss some implications. So first of all, the one motivation is to understand what is the Lorentzian meaning of the gravitational entropy, right? So, you know, we know the area entropy relation, and we can derive that from the gravity path integral. But it's somewhat surprising that the gravity path integral that computes, you know, the Rényi entropies that feed into the derivation of the area entropy relation, that the saddle, they're dominated by weakly curved gravity saddles that are well described in low energy theory. So you can do a calculation that looks like some perturbative calculation in gravity around the saddle and get the right answer for the entropy. It's a little surprising because you usually don't think you get that from the microscopic theory. But the Lorentzian meaning of this calculation isn't too obvious because, and in a way that's the whole point, the Euclidean time circle shrinks in the interior. That's the Euclidean continuation of the black hole horizon. And so it doesn't have any obvious interpretation as a trace. Okay, so can we give it an interpretation as a trace is one of the questions here. Now, another motivation is there's some subtlety in defining entanglement entropy, even in quantum field theory. Ooh. Oh, excuse me. For future reference, don't speak and take cough drop at the same time. Oh my God. Oh, excuse me. All right. Don't need the Heimlich maneuver this time. Just, thanks. Sorry about that. Ah, okay. Right, so even in quantum field theory, the Hilbert space doesn't factorize into ones associated to subregions. That's related to the UV divergences of the entanglement entropy. And in the gravity effective theory, it doesn't look like it factorizes either in some very straightforward way that I'll reveal. But in QFT, we also often compute entanglement entropy using some kind of regulated calculations. For instance, if you just put the thing on a lattice, you get some answer. But the lattice calculations, when you take the continuum limit, give you an extra piece of data when you define entanglement entropy, which is the boundary conditions you get by ending the lattice. So you really end up with some map which splits the original Hilbert space into a factorized one defined with boundary conditions. Now, it's potentially easier to understand how this works actually in gravity rather than in quantum field theory in a funny way, because in gravity, the exact answer is finite, and it shouldn't depend on the choice of boundary conditions. And I would say in QFT, we don't really fully know whether what pieces of the answer depend on the choice of boundary conditions or not. So with Tomasz Dumitrescu, we've been trying to understand that QFT issue. So this is another motivation, seeing how does that play out in a very simple example like JT gravity. And then the other sort of more technical motivation is we have the quantum HRT formula, and it tells us that we should extremize the generalized entropy, the area term plus the bulk entropy. But it's not clear, I think, how to define the gravity contribution to the bulk entropy when you consider a general bulk region where the boundary is not defined as the geometrically extremal surface. And if you want to extremize the quantity where you compute the bulk entropy for any surface, you better know how to define it. And you know, even to specify the meaning of the location of your bulk region, you need to make many gauge choices and pick some boundary condition for the gravitons, and these will affect the result for the entanglement entropy. So if you don't do it the right way, you'll get some different answer. Of course, this only affects the result for the entanglement entropy at second order in the gravity expansion. The first order guy, you could just compute the correction at the original surface. But if we want to go to higher orders in G Newton and include the effects of the gravitons, I think we don't really have a complete definition of how to do that. I should say, of course, in the examples that people have been discussing recently involving entanglement islands, it's not the graviton contribution that was important. It's the contribution of other quantum fields which are enhanced by different parameters. So then you can ignore this issue and still get an interesting answer. Okay, so just for simplicity, I'm going to consider the case of the 2D JT gravity. That's defined by this Lagrangian. So it's just the metric is set by a constraint to have constant negative curvature. And the whole story is just about the dynamics of some nearly ADS2 boundaries out here. And the boundary conditions set the dilaton to be fixed and the intrinsic metric to be fixed to some big number that one scales out to infinity, and that's the nearly ADS limit. So I'm sure everyone here is very familiar with it. And with Dan Harlow, he analyzed this in a very straightforward way. And you know, if you look at this two-sided black hole, you just get a two-dimensional phase space, which you can label by the black hole mass, which is given by the square of the horizon value of the dilaton. Analogous to the area is the value of the dilaton here. And one other variable, which is the relative time shift between the two boundaries. So what that means is if I start at, say, time t, which means here and here, then from the left side, I shoot out a transverse geodesic. It always goes through the bifurcate horizon, comes out over here, and then this distance is the time shift. Now, of course, the time shift is like a time operator. Its commutation with the Hamiltonian is I. This is not a good operator in quantum mechanics. And in the space-time picture, maybe you'd be suspicious of it anyway because it's teleologically defined. You have to know the whole classical space-time. And in quantum mechanics, we really only should formulate data on one time slice and then evolve it, right? In other words, the thing here may not commute with something down here, so how do we really make sense of this operator exactly? Maybe there's something wrong with it. So, but you can analyze the system with other variables, and it's equally easy. And the simplest one is the fixed temporal gauge. So think about an ADM-like slicing, fixed temporal gauge, by going to maximum volume slices. Here, that means geodesics. So as time evolves up along both boundaries, if I start at t equals 0, the length of the geodesic grows. And its regularized length is a nice variable in terms of which the Hamiltonian ends up looking just like Louisville quantum mechanics. And we should thank Henry Lin for pointing out a typo that Dan and I had in our paper that led to a much uglier, very similar structure, but uglier result. So that got nicer. Now, this defines, of course, a simple Hilbert space without any obvious tensor factor structure between the left and right boundaries of the system. And it looks like a scattering problem. And it has continuous spectrum because of the infinite range of L, out at large L, right? So the potential fixes L goes to minus infinity, which would be unphysical anyway. Well, since it's a regularized length, but the potential fixes the short side of L, but as L goes to infinity, it's just unbound. So that's why you get a continuous spectrum. Actually, I think it would be interesting if something like the overlaps between configurations with different Ls could be computed by Euclidean path integral techniques involving higher topologies, and then you'll find that they're not all independent, perhaps. Maybe you can end up with a better answer here, although probably not in the pure JT theory by itself, because it's not rich enough, I would imagine. But it might be interesting to look at. In any case, the just this Hamiltonian, that doesn't tell you too much. We need to know what kind of states to talk about, and the natural one is the black hole state, which can be computed by some path integral. So we take the ADS boundary with a length beta in the renormalized units, and then some boundary here given by this geodesic of length L, and you compute the path integral. And we did that semi-classically, and it can also be done exactly. You get some result knowing a Bessel function, and then you can change to any basis you like energy basis, or this is basically energy basis, it's horizon area basis, which I'll use later, and you get a formula like this that was done by Zhenren Yang. So of course there's no factorization, but if you look at the normalization of this state, then it's equal to the Schwarzian Euclidean path integral for the full disk that was computed by Stanford and Witten. So the partition function on the disk just gets interpreted as the normalization of some state. Okay. Now, how can one try to say something about entanglement entropy in this context? So first of all, let's go back to just quantum field theory. And in QFT, of course, the definition of entanglement entropy requires introducing boundary conditions that factorize the Hilbert space. And some map that maps the original Hilbert space, which is not a factorization, inside of some guy like this. And in QFT, you need to take some finite split. You take, you know, a little wall, imagine of width epsilon around the edge of your region. And at the end, you want to set that epsilon to zero. So that's kind of the procedure. And then, you know, this mapping will depend on that epsilon. So what's different in gravity is not really the lack of factorization of the Hilbert space per se, but rather that there's some topological obstruction to finding this kind of map and boundary condition that obeys an appropriate set of rules. That's really what's different, I would say. Not just that it doesn't factorize. You know, Pirch and Simons theory on S2, the Hilbert space is one-dimensional, doesn't factorize, but by this method, it's assigned an entanglement entropy, which is non-trivial because if you try to cut your topological insulator in two pieces, you have boundary conditions that give you the WZW model chiral modes on the boundaries, and then you'll get a non-zero answer here. So there's a unique state for Chern-Simons theory on the sphere, gets mapped into something here with considerable entanglement, but okay, so can we see the same thing work for gravity is really the question today. Now, an obvious property that the splitting map has to have is that at least in limit that you remove the regulator, this is in the QFT context, that it looks like an isometry in the sense that this thing gets unitarily mapped to its image in the factorized space. Otherwise, you just multiply the state by 75 and get some random answer. In addition, you want certainly this algebraic notion of locality, which says that if I look at the algebra of local observables on the left, then it must map to something that acts only here, and the algebra of observables on the right should act as something that acts on this factor. Okay, so one would want to demand that. But those two rules don't actually lead to unique answers. If I just demand those rules, I can get any answer I want for any theory. It's easy to illustrate that for JT gravity. In that case, the left and right algebras are kind of trivial. They're just generated by the Hamiltonian. Right? The only thing you measure on the left is the energy or powers of the energy. So the two algebras are, left and right algebras are equal by the Gauss law constraint, and they're part of the center of the whole algebra of the splitting. So it's kind of a trivial story. And so therefore, any map that maps an energy eigenstate to a factorized state like this, where I is the label of the factorized Hilbert space, and D of E is an arbitrary function, obeys the rules of the previous slide. And the result resulting entanglement entropy that I compute is something arbitrary. It just depends on what I chose for the DV. I get any answer. And in the same way in QFT, I mean, in pure chain assignments theory, I could say the same words, or in general, I could just append extra map state to some random entangled thing and introduce extra factors into the entropy. So that's clearly not something you want to allow in order to get a meaningful definition. And I think the good candidate is that we should really require a stronger notion of locality, which is that the cutting map itself should be defined by the path integral rule with the local boundary condition. So you excise this point, and then I do a little bit of path integration with the boundary condition to produce the split map. Okay, so if we should require that. And then if you require this notion, then say in the context of the QFT, like in Schoen-Simons theory, you get the unique answer that is the expected answer. Now, before we try to do that in gravity, we can just say, is there some simple ways of splitting the Hilbert space? So one natural way to do it, which is also discussed in the paper of Kitaev and Sir, is to think of the original system as being defined by the two positions of the two boundaries in a fixed global radius tau, because the manifold always has the same constant negative curvature, so I just keep track of where the boundaries sit. And so I get two quantum mechanics of two points in global radius tau modulo the SL2R isometries, which don't have any intrinsic meaning. And so that gives the same counting of the classical phase space. If I have a point in radius 2 has a 4D phase space. If I have two points, it's eight-dimensional. And then when I gauge this 3D group, it removes 6, give me back the 2 that we had before. Okay. And so then you can define a splitting map just by removing this SL2R gauge constraint. Well, that's an easy splitting map. It's not clear whether it obeys this rule. It certainly obeys these rules, but whether that means we like the answer or not, okay, we'll have to understand. So, first let me tell you what the result is for doing that. So the result is you get something that looks like the Schwarzian quantum mechanics just on each side. And if you introduce the usual variable that simplifies this action, chi, where e to the chi is t dot, then you can exactly rewrite it in terms of a Hamiltonian of this type. Actually, you can easily see from this how to get back to the Liouville quantum mechanics. It corresponds to some gauging, which fixes this momentum, and that's how you end up with this guy and this term, roughly speaking. So if we fix this momentum this momentum PT, then this thing looks like the so-called Morse potential. So if you find that, so in the details of the story, the eigenfunctions of the Morse potential appear everywhere. There's some things called Whitaker functions, but I sort of suppressed a lot of this. Now, just from the Lorentzian point of view, you can ask, with this way of splitting the Hilbert space, what could a splitting map be? And there's a really unique answer that obeys some basic consistency conditions. So first of all, it's supposed to map energies, eigenstates to energy eigenstates, because that means that's what's required by preserving the left algebra, which measures the energy. And it's supposed to be isometric map. But there's another feature, which is that when I talk about the system with the two boundaries, I'm allowed states in which the two boundary points are time-like related. And those don't make any sense from the original gravity problem, because they're supposed to be the two ends of the spatial cup. So you have to find the special states that vanish at time-like separation. And so that leads to this unique possibility. So in other words, if we have an energy eigenstate of the original problem with energy given by S squared, where S is the horizon size, it maps to this state in terms of these four variables in this bigger system. In other words, wave functions here are described by, for each copy, a function of t and chi, the two positional-like variables. Okay, so you get some answer like this. And then you can compute the entanglement entropy. So I can then trace out the right variables and compute the entropy of the resulting density matrix, and I get some answer. And it turns out that that answer looks like the bulk contribution to the entanglement entropy. I'll come back to it. But at this point, it's not really clear why you should take that and add to it the area term. This looked like a semi-arbitrary splitting map from an abstract point of view. Sounds physically very natural, but maybe if we use different variables to describe the problem, we've done something different. Now, can we give this an interpretation that looks more local in the bulk? You know, here we just reframed the problem in terms of some boundary points and then did something that looked natural there, but what does it mean in the bulk? So we can get the same Hilbert space, the same factorized Hilbert space, from a bulk boundary condition that at the cutting boundary fixes the metric and the extrinsic curvature to zero, okay? Or, now that sounds a little bit singular sounding in gravity, but if we worked in the first order formalism of JT gravity, the 2D SL2RBF theory that's already been discussed in this meeting, this is the natural boundary condition in BF theory where you just set the gauge field along the boundary to zero. Right, one component of the gauge field gives you the dribine, which is, this y-bine, sorry, which is set to zero. That sets the metric along the boundary to zero, and the other component, the spin connection, and you set that to zero, which tells you the extrinsic curvature is zero. Now, setting the metric to zero is actually good. It says that the boundary, if we think of a Euclidean path integral, so in the Euclidean path integral, because we cut out, we use this boundary to cut the surface, it turns into cutting out the extremal point, right? So we kind of excise the point in the Euclidean path integral with a little boundary. So maybe just to make it clear, the picture is like we started with some state that we produced like this, and then we wanted to split it like that, and that produces a state in these two copies. And then if I glued two of them together, that would be like cutting out a little hole in the middle. And so if we do this computation for, say, the nth Rényi entropy, where we take the boundary circle around n times, and we cut out this little hole in the middle, if the metric shrinks to zero, that's good. It means that the hole shrinks away. So if the hole really shrinks away and you get the smooth manifold there, it would be the original Euclidean path integral, and then you would be, have gotten the right answer. That's in a way why the answer in gravity is not divergent, unlike the answers in QFT. Okay. But the problem is that the integral of the extrinsic curvature around the smooth point is supposed to be 2 pi and not zero. And it's very hard to, or equivalently, we could say in somewhat more involved language, if we try to relate Euclidean JT gravity to SL2R BF theory, it's not exactly the same. Only certain topologies of the SL2R bundles are supposed to be included. The SL2R has non-trivial bundles because of the compact SL2, which is the spin Euclidean spin connection. And only certain topologies are supposed to be included. Equivalently, we could say we really work with the universal cover of this guy, where the SL2 is not compact. And then you have to insert some operator, which is like a defect operator, which says that the holonomy of in that direction around it is 2 pi. Now in SL2R, 2 pi is the same as zero, but in SL2R BF theory, we sum all numbers, and you're not allowed to just pick one. So I think it's better to say we work in the cover, and then we insert a defect that sets the holonomy to the one we want, 2 pi. That's, again, it's like the central element of the universal cover. Okay. You mean in a space-time sense, or? Could you state the question? Oh yeah, the question was, does the operator have support all the way out to infinity? Because you could go around it from far away. Well, yeah, in a certain sense, if you went around, I mean, I'm not exactly sure how to answer this question, because when you're talking about going around it, you mean in a Euclidean sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So, it's, yeah, I mean, I don't quite know how to answer, but yes, it's a non-trivial topological operator. So any non-trivial topological operator, if you go around it, it does. I don't know how to answer, but Anyway, so now it's very, it is really impossible to pick a local boundary condition that would set this holonomy to be 2 pi, right? So let me sort of draw this picture. That's what I drew over there. The original path integral phrase in this language has a defect operator inserted in it by definition. That was the BF path integral that equaled the gravity one. So now we can try to do one of two things. We can try to excise the defect with the boundary, but that means that the boundary condition has to be so that when it shrinks down, it produces the defect. That is really impossible because the defect is defined non-locally in Euclidean time. It says that the total integral around it is 2 pi. That's why you could set it to be 0. So you could set the integral to be 0 by setting the guy to be 0. But they can't set the guy to be something specific so that the integral is guaranteed to work right. In particular, in the nth, if I, tried to make it work in some case, if I computed the nth Rainey entropy, then I will get the guy n times, and I will get n times the defect. But that's not the correct rule. That's the rule that says that I have a 2 pi n conical excess. That's like the QFT rule. Okay, so this is not possible. Instead, you could just draw the place where you excise the hole over here. Maybe I should have put that in the center and shoved the defect to the side. Okay, and then you'll do a computation that looks like a trace in some easy to define low energy gravity Hilbert space, but not of the original partition function, which here is just the thermal one, but that thing times the defect. Okay, now, how does it work in the black hole case? So another way of saying it is that the splitting map that I talked about before, where you just separate the two boundary points and throw out the SL2R constraint, is not the, if I use the Euclidean path integral to define that, the boundary condition with AT equals 0, then it wouldn't give an isometric map. If I combine it with half of the defect operator, then I get the isometric map that I discussed before, the naive splitting. And so if I compute the Rainey entropy in this way, I will have this defect and then the thermal trace. Or I could package it in a different way, like this. I can absorb the defect into here, but then I'm left with the shift by 1. Okay? So this rho beta is the image under the simple isometric cutting map that I talked about at the beginning where I throw out the constraint, which is not given by path integral rule. It's given by a path integral rule together with half of the defect. Okay, so I can split it out each way. It doesn't really matter. And either way, when I compute the Rainey from the von Neumann entropy from the Raineys, I get a contribution from the defect operator, basically a term that looks like trace of the log of the defect operator times the density matrix. So if I take a general state in the energy basis, S is the horizon area, then I get results that look like this. Or if I apply it in the black hole state, you could reproduce the exact formula for the black hole entropy, where the area term here comes from the log of the defect operator and the rest comes from the quantum contribution. So what's supposed to be the lesson here? So first of all, just to say again, the classical term in the entropy formula is the log of this defect. What is that? Well, very generally, because of the way this defect operator is defined, it's exactly the generator of time translation along the cut boundary. Or equivalently, at least here, it's the same as the local boost of the horizon, and so that's why you got the area operator, because that's the guy that generates the local boost. But this definition is in some ways nicer because it gives you a way of defining the entropy, writing a formula like this formula with an area term and an entropy term to all orders in gravitational perturbation theory. Because first of all, the operator, the log of the defect, or this local boost, or this local generator of time translation along the cut boundary is defined in the split Hilbert space. And the splitting is defined in some geometrically intrinsic way. The location of the cut is a dynamical variable. You path integrate over it, or it's one of the things that acts in this Hilbert space. So the structure is that there is some map from the original gravity Hilbert space to the split one, and then which has a generator of translations along the cut boundary, and then that guy gives you the area operator, and if you use that formula, you will get the right answer to all orders. Okay, now, just a couple of... So that's really the main point, but just a few sort of further directions in the last, like, two or three slides. So what about in the exact theory? If you had an exact theory that included the black hole, included the microstates, then there would be some system with a very large number of degrees of freedom at the boundary. And then I would be able to, in that system, define an approximate time operator. Can't exist exactly, but... And with that approximate time operator, I could write a local boundary condition that fixes the total cone angle, because the time operator will count the time around the defect. So that's somehow why this answer gets produced by the exact theory of microstates. And in a way, it's because the only input of the exact theory in the computation of the entanglement entropy is through that time operator, sort of explains why there's a universal formula. In a way, I would say this is similar to Strominger's old picture of 2D CFT describing black hole entropy through the Cardy formula. So consistency and the symmetries demanded that you had a CFT with a certain width of your Sorg group with a certain central charge, and then the Cardy formula told you the density of states. So this is kind of the analog without having the extra direction of the 2D CFT. So the quantum mechanics has to produce the appropriate time operator that will, so there sort of has to be many degrees of freedom extra on the boundary to make it work, but here it can only work approximately. Okay. Now we can also, I think, generalize, one slide. Okay. So I think we could also include matter in this story. It wasn't really specific to JT gravity, and the way you would do that is to use the logic of how you would define entanglement entropy with boundary conditions for that matter and fold it in. Here in the same, in higher dimensions. In higher dimensions, it would be interesting to see what the results look like at higher order in gravitational perturbation theory. In this case, although I said it will define it at higher orders, it wasn't very interesting because the thing is one loop exact, but it would be interesting to apply this idea in a case where it would be non-trivial. And then one final thought, before I stop, which is, I think an interesting possibility is if we imagine a theory where there are no curvature terms in the Lagrangian at some higher energy scale, so we don't have the JT term phi square root gr, just have terms involving the metric and the coupling of metric to matter, and they're generated by integrating out matter degrees of freedom. So if you could achieve that, and maybe the matter degrees of freedom will have to be some brains or something, I'm not totally sure how it could work, but if you could achieve that, then the story would have worked without the defect operator, because you would not need a constraint on the cone angle, because you will not have the curvature term, and so there won't be any defect operator at that scale. So you could kind of generate the defect operator in the lower energy theory, but there you wouldn't need it. And then you would be able to find simple boundary conditions that would lead at least approximately to the whole entropy. So I don't know if we can find such a model, but maybe you need something fancier than just some matter fields. All right, so that's all I have to say. Thanks.
So actually, the last thing you said is a feature at leading order for any Randall-Sundrum theory, which is induced gravity, and exactly for this DSDS where there's no Planck brain at all.
Right, that's an interesting point. Yeah, so maybe, I wonder what that means.
Yeah, it might help. I had a related question. Earlier you're doing the general case, which is great. But you had a slide where you said, well, if you're actually interested in a division that corresponds to an extremal surface in some state, it was much simpler. So how much of this machinery would be required in that case?
Well, so the idea was that, I mean, the The idea was that when you want to compute the higher order corrections to the HRT formula, you need to consider surfaces that are not the extremal surface. And then we wouldn't be completely sure how to compute the graviton contribution to the entropy. So I think that was kind of the thing that this was supposed to resolve. That's right. Right, right. So even so even suppose you have the two-sided black hole, you know, the thermofield double state, and then you have, you know, you think, oh, you should just split it at the extremal point. It's totally obvious. But when you want to, yeah, well, maybe in that case, let's see. I mean, well.
I mean, is there a statement you can make just by symmetry in that case, say?
Right, so you say, I don't need to extremize the thing that I compute somewhere else. I just know where to compute it, and so I just compute it. Yeah, you could say that, but even in that case, it's not really clear what boundary condition you're supposed to use for the gravitons, right? And it's a little bit tricky to discuss keeping the boundary at the extremal point when we imagine that the metric starts to become perturbed. It's a little tricky, I think, right? So in other words, in the original metric, yes, that point is preserved, made special by some symmetries, but when I want to compute, you know, the second order correction to the graviton entanglement, I already have perturbed the surface a little bit by the first order correction, and then I don't know anymore where to put it. That's the potential issue, I think.
So, two questions, well, related questions. So if I heard correctly, in the pure JT case, you don't really have a gauge invariant splitting. You have to relax the constraints. Is that correct?
Well, I would say that we always map the Hilbert space to one to a different Hilbert space, which is factorized.
Yeah, but
even in a free scalar, if you want to compute the entanglement entropy, there's no gauge symmetry.
Yeah.
The Hilbert space doesn't factorize. We still want to map it to some factorized one, maybe with Neumann boundary conditions. So
yeah, there are choices, but you don't break the gauge symmetry in the pure field theory case. But just to mention, you know, I think a way around that is, you know, if you do couple it to matter, then there are gauge invariant ways of doing this, and you know, also in higher dimensions. And you know, at least some of that structure is what I was describing, you know, an hour ago in my talk, roughly. So.
Right. But do you think that, do you think that would give you a way, I mean, do you think you'd get a way to define a boundary condition so that it would, so that when you shrink it down, it doesn't do anything, for example?
I guess we'd have to figure out.
Yeah, maybe we should talk.
How to relate these things.
Yeah.
If we take the Schwarzian theory on the circle, then we have to quotient by the SL2R, and we also impose the winding condition. It seems like either of these two things would be enough to make it not be a trace in a Hilbert space. Are they related, or is one more basic than the other? Or?
Well, I think the issue with the winding is more bit. I mean, first of all, the quotient by SL2R is an overall infinite factor, right?
Well, yeah, it's finite after doing the quotient, but the fact that you did the quotient is, I think, enough to show that it wouldn't be a trace in a Hilbert space.
I would say that obstruction is less. Well, okay, first of all, once you allow this defect operator, then of course you can eliminate that infinity too, if you want. So I can include a projector onto a particular, you know, a projector that breaks the SL2R symmetry in the defect if you want to. So once you allow the defect operator, you can resolve. I can also eliminate this issue, right? But
the periodicity condition actually doesn't break that. The winding condition doesn't break that.
The winding condition doesn't break that, but suppose you took the winding to be not 2 pi, but 2 pi plus epsilon, then you'll already eliminate the SL2R. And in the limit that epsilon goes to 0, I think you get the same answer, for instance. Or you could just by hand, include a projector onto a particular sort of angle in SL2R. That would make the answer finite. I would say it would make the answer the wrong answer, but in other words, in JT gravity, the answer is infinity. And the interesting thing is say the derivative of the answer with respect to the temperature or something that removes that overall infinity. But I would say with the defect operator, you get the correct answer of infinity. But it's the correctly structured infinity that has the correct dependence on the temperature. Does that make sense? Sorry.
So I was wondering if you were in higher dimensions and you had higher derivative theories of gravity, what would be the nature of the defect operator? Because you'd need to reproduce not just the area term, but some appropriate corrected answer.
Right, yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I'm not exactly sure how it would play out. I mean, in the simplest possibility, it might just be that the generator of time translation along the cut boundary is a more complicated object in the higher derivative theory. That would be my guess, but I wouldn't swear that it works like that since I haven't tried. But yeah, I think that kind of thing would be interesting to understand.
Thanks.
So in the Kitavshu story, in order to define the trace, they need to introduce another operator like P operator.
Mm-hmm.
What's the relation between this defect operator and their operator?
Yeah, that's right. That's a very good question. I'm not entirely sure. Their operator involves some projection onto states which have the two endpoints space-like related rather than time-like related. So I don't think it's exact. I don't think it can be the same object because that guy was just a projector, and this one has some non-trivial spectrum. But yeah, I think in the paper of Kitaev and Su, they didn't define a local boundary condition that would split the Hilbert space. So then, if you don't do that, then I can write many isometric cutting maps and get all different sorts of answers, and so the result can play out in a variety of ways, let's say. Yeah.
You put the defect operator outside the cut because you said that the Rényi entropy, you don't want the integrated extrinsic curvature to be 2 pi n. But in all the gravitational calculations of Rényi entropy I'm familiar with, there is a curvature singularity. It's either Dong's brains or like, if you do it on a black hole, there's all another curvature singularity, right? So
I think you're referring to the calculations where you take the Zn quotient of the cover, and that's what gives you a 2 pi divided by n singularity. But the point was that in the cover, there was no singularity. Right? But you shouldn't be doing the path integral in the quotient of the geometry because the loop determinants know whether, only the classical on-shell action descends, but in a simple way.
All right, let's thank Daniel again.